When I was a student in Aberystwyth, I went one evening with a friend to watch a performance of Hamlet. And it was an unusual performance. For one thing, it didn't take place in a theatre. The venue was the ruined castle near the seafront, with which some of you will be familiar in Aberystwyth. And then for another thing, each scene in the play was performed in a different part of the castle. So all of us in the audience, we had to keep relocating ourselves. Some older folk indeed had brought with them portable seats, and they were constantly lugging these seats to the next spot for the next installment of the drama. And I suppose it's a bit like that with this series of ours on these Sunday mornings. We're looking at different temptations Jesus faced across the last 3 years of his life. And so each Sunday morning, we're like the audience there at the castle in Aberystwyth, picking up our seats, metaphorically speaking, and lugging them to the next spot where some new scene of temptation is unfolding. And this morning, then, we're plonking ourselves down in Matthew chapter 16. And as we watch this scene of temptation unfold, how do we react to it? At that Shakespearean performance, whenever everyone was in the right place for the next installment and it was underway, there could be laughter from the audience, there could be tears from the audience, there could be stunned silences from the audience, a whole range of reactions in any given scene. But what about this scene here? Not from Hamlet, but from the story of Jesus and his temptations. What are our reactions to it, to what we observe in Matthew 16, verses 21 to 23? Well, I suggest we react in a number of ways. First of all, we gasp. We gasp. Just for a moment, I want to go to that other passage that I read from this morning, chapter 18. And in that first section of Matthew 18, Jesus describes his people in a striking way, little ones. That's what he calls his people there in the opening section of Matthew 18, little ones. Now, he doesn't mean by that that all Christians are short in stature and dainty in the way that they're built. No, Christians can be tall, Christians can be heavily built. They are little ones in a figurative sense. Indeed, he seems to be making a couple of points when he calls them little ones, one of which is this. He's saying they're fragile. His people are little ones in the sense that they are fragile. I mean, think of literal little ones. When you're walking around this building after the service, you walk carefully, don't you? Looking where you're going. Because any moment, Reuben or Rosie or Anna or someone might be just in front of you, and if you charge into them at full speed, you're going to knock them flying. Little ones are fragile. And Christians are fragile. They can be going along nicely in the Christian life, making ever such good progress. And then some temptation or problem or pressure can suddenly come along and knock them flying, flinging them right off the path of trusting God and obeying his will. We've seen it, haven't we? We know of people in that category. We've seen it and we've trembled at how little it takes and in what a short amount of time someone can be floored, poleaxed. 1 minute moving forward encouragingly as a disciple of Jesus, the next minute sprawled on the ground, his or her discipleship in tatters. Christians are fragile, susceptible to stumbling blocks that trip us up disastrously and propel us off course. And in that passage in chapter 18, you sense how burdened Jesus is as he speaks of his people's fragility. He's the ultimate pastor, the ultimate shepherd. The weakness and vulnerability of his sheep, his people, exercises him greatly. The first part of verse 7 is a much more tender expression, I think, than is conveyed in our English versions. The word translated woe can also mean alas. And the temptations to sin is better rendered stumbling blocks. And he's really saying something like, alas, This world is so full of stumbling blocks for my little ones. You're a parent, and you have a toddler who's in those early days of being able to move about on her own legs. And you're at the play park, and you can't take your eyes off her for a single moment because there are bigger kids running around who could easily upend her. And there are swings being used which could smash into her. And there are things sticking out of the ground all over the place that present a major trip hazard. And as you frantically follow her around that place, you could say, "Alas, this park is so full of stumbling blocks for my little girl." And I'm saying that's how Jesus feels there in Matthew 18. Keenly aware of how endangered his little ones, his people are in this world. And so that's my excursion into chapter 18. Now come back with me to chapter 16. And here too, Jesus talks about the same concept of a stumbling block that suddenly brings crashing to the ground the person who a moment before had been trusting and obeying God. He uses in chapter 16 that exact same word that I'm translating, stumbling block. However, there's a twist, an extraordinary twist. Here in chapter 16, the fragile little one, susceptible to being knocked disastrously off course, it's not a disciple in this case, it's the master. It's Jesus himself. The middle of verse 23, "You are a hindrance," or stumbling block, that same word as in chapter 18, verse 7. "You are a stumbling block to me." To me. Is that not remarkable? Not "you are a stumbling block to the young and immature disciples around you." That's normally the kind of thing Jesus is saying when he talks about stumbling blocks. But here it's "you are a stumbling block to me." Here Jesus is the one who's endangered. As he walks this road to the cross of Calvary, he senses the terrible possibility of something flinging him off that road. He senses the terrible possibility of being flawed and making no further progress in that direction. And you see what I mean then? That as we observe this moment here, we gasp. We gasp. This is not what we're accustomed to in the Gospels. We're accustomed to Jesus warning others about the horror of stumbling. We're accustomed to Jesus speaking of the horror of stumbling from a shepherd's perspective, concerned about his sheep. That's how it usually works. But here he speaks of the horror of stumbling, and it's himself he's concerned about. Here it's his trust and obedience, his continuation in the will of God that is threatened. If you, believer, ever think that this whole idea at the heart of our series, this whole idea of Jesus being tempted, is a bit theoretical and a bit unreal, this is the one sentence, perhaps more than any other, that you need to come back to. "You are a stumbling block to me," Jesus says. Stumbling blocks in Jesus' vocabulary are never theoretical and unreal. When Jesus talks about stumbling blocks, he means what he says. He means what he says in chapter 18 when he's talking about stumbling blocks there amongst us, amongst his people, and he means what he says here in chapter 16. This is a frank expression of how weak and vulnerable he feels in the presence of temptation. It's a stumbling block to me. It's an existential threat to my mission. I'm in real danger of falling off the path here. That's what Jesus is saying in Matthew 16:23. Truly, we gasp. Secondly, we groan. We groan. Because whom is he addressing when he says, "You are a stumbling block to me"? Who's the "you"? And the answer is, of course, Peter. He's not addressing some Pharisee or Sadducee. He's not addressing some skeptic or enemy. He's addressing Peter, of all people. Peter is the obstacle that threatens to topple Jesus and send him careering off the path that he's supposed to be on. So in verse 21, Jesus starts spelling out to his disciples what that path looks like and how it's going to involve suffering and death. And in response to this, in verse 22, Peter doesn't gently question what Jesus has just said. No, he vehemently rejects it. He takes Jesus to one side to show how earnest he is and how much he means what he's about to say. And then his ensuing repudiation of the cross, well, the word emphatic doesn't do it justice, does it? Far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you. This is quite some outburst. His previous outburst, recorded in verse 16, showed him to be the kind of strong rock on which Jesus could build his church. This outburst shows him to be the kind of treacherous rock over which Jesus could stumble and fall from his mission. And so you get my heading then. We groan as we see Peter putting the cross of Calvary in peril. Peter suddenly changing from a foundation stone to a stumbling stone. We groan. What on earth is he thinking? What is going through his mind here as he jeopardizes the very salvation of the world? Well, in verse 23, Jesus puts his finger on what Peter is thinking. Or at least he puts his finger on how Peter is thinking. This is what Jesus says. He says, Peter is thinking in a human way. He's thinking in a human way. You see, human logic always finds objectionable the concept of welcoming and embracing and magnifying the cross. Because welcoming and embracing and magnifying the cross is a divine concept that just does not resonate with the instincts and inclinations of the human mind. The human mind is drawn to power and prestige and that kind of thing, not to an old rugged cross. And that's how Peter then can become this stumbling block here that threatens Jesus' mission. He's not suddenly gone start raving mad. He's not having a psychotic episode or something. He's simply applying human logic to what he has just heard Jesus say. That at least is Jesus' assessment in verse 23. You are not setting your minds on the things of God, but on the things of man. I just want to linger on this for a moment before we move on. Thankfully, you and I this morning cannot be stumbling blocks to Jesus. We cannot impede his progress to the cross because the cross has now taken place. We're on the other side of it, and the cross is irreversible, thank God. But you and I can still, in other ways, resist and push back against the cross. We can still think humanly instead of divinely sometimes, even as those whose minds have been enlightened, we can. Because that's the interesting thing about Peter. After that previous outburst that I mentioned a moment ago in verse 16, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. What does Jesus say to Peter there? He says, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven, verse 17. So Peter then had been set free from the logic of flesh and blood. He had been set free from the thoughts of mere man. God had supernaturally opened Peter's mind to higher truths than unaided human reason can attain. That's what Jesus is saying there in verse 17. And God has done the same for us, if we are Christian believers this morning. And that's how you and I have fundamentally embraced the cross of Calvary. Basically, we have, haven't we? We've taken our sins there. We can sing, we stand forgiven at the cross. But even with those supernaturally open minds, we can still wobble. Peter had been set free, as I said, from the thoughts of man. And yet here in our passage now, just a few verses later than Jesus says he's been set free from the thoughts of man, he's not setting his mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. Peter wobbled. This supernaturally enlightened man could wobble, and you and I can wobble as well. So when we've sinned, and instead of going straight to Calvary, we derive comfort in that moment from totting up all our good works over the past week, or from making lots of impressive resolutions how we're going to live from now on. That's raw human logic. It's a Peter-like aversion to the cross. We're not setting our minds on the things of God, but on the things of man. When we aspire to be an impressive church with slick marketing and charismatic leaders and high-flying people flocking to our services, that's raw human logic that has lost touch with the fact that a weak and pathetic cross is God's modus operandi. We're not setting our minds on the things of God, but on the things of man. When we experience some personal struggle and we conclude bitterly that it spells the end of our usefulness to the kingdom, and we take umbrage at God for disabling us like that when we could otherwise have achieved so much for him, that's raw human reasoning that ignores the logic of the cross. We're not setting our minds on the things of God, but on the things of man. So even then, as we groan this morning that Peter, of all people, is the stumbling block to Jesus here, let's be alert to the fact that the way of thinking which makes Peter a stumbling block to Jesus here, that can enter our minds too. And let's seek to be men and women gripped by the logic of God, not the logic of man, the logic of God, which is in fact the logic of the cross. So how do we react as we sit on our seats watching this scene of temptation unfold? Well, we gasp, we groan, but thirdly, we grasp, we grasp. In verse 23, Jesus, following Peter's outburst, says three things. Now, we've considered the sentence, "You are a hindrance or stumbling block to me." And we've considered the sentence, "You are not setting your minds on the things of God, but on the things of man." But there's also that opening sentence in the verse, isn't there? Where Jesus tells Peter to get behind him. Now, we'll come to what that language of getting behind Jesus means. But of course, the really striking feature of that opening sentence is how Jesus addresses Peter. "Get behind me, Satan." And perhaps our initial reaction is that Jesus has just gotten the wrong name. You know, Satan, Simon, reasonably similar. Perhaps it's just a mistake, slip of the tongue. But then after a moment or two's reflection, we probably abandon that rather crass explanation and conclude that he's just mad at Peter and reaching for the worst possible insult that he can think of. But then, with a little bit more reflection still, the penny hopefully drops, and we grasp what is going on here. And we grasp that this is a repeat, actually, of that wilderness temptation that we looked at 2 weeks ago. There, you remember, Satan tried to divert Jesus from the cross. He tried to divert Jesus from the cross there by offering Jesus an easier option, an easier route. "Don't go and die on a cross. Just just bow down, just fall down on the ground in front of me. It'll only take a moment. And you can have your inheritance. The nations will be yours. And here too then, in Matthew 16, as in Matthew 4, Satan is operative, trying to divert Jesus from the cross. Now you might think, well, compared to that other scene, this is a bit of a half-hearted attempt by Satan this time. There in the wilderness, he went for a full-on face-to-face meeting with Jesus. He pulled out all the stops. Here he's kind of in the background somewhere, behind the scenes. No one would even know that he's involved at all if Jesus didn't call him out in verse 23. It's a bit lazy on his part. Obviously, he's pretty much given up by now. But that would be quite the wrong way of looking at this scene. If anything, Satan is upping his game here when you compare it to chapter 4. If anything, Satan is upping his game. The indirectness of his approach this time, his use of an agent, of a middleman, Peter, that's precisely what makes it so cunning. Indeed, it brings us back, does it not, to the big picture of what Jesus' temptations are really all about. Remember, they're about a second Adam walking the earth, to quote again Stuart Townend's song. Because think about it. How did Satan tempt the first Adam? Did he approach him directly? No. He used an agent, a middleman, or a middle woman, more precisely. The hand that stretched out and offered Adam the forbidden fruit wasn't Satan's hand. It was Eve's hand. Genesis 3, verse 6. She gave some to her husband. This woman, whose praises Adam was a few verses earlier singing, "This at last is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh." This woman is the one urging him to eat the fruits. It makes eating the fruit seem so right, so proper somehow, when the proposal comes from such a trusted source, his precious companion Eve. And so you see, having seen this strategy work so well once, Satan uses it again here. He brought down the first Adam this way. Well, he'll bring down the second Adam this way too. He won't say himself to Jesus, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you." He'll have Peter say it. This man whose praises Jesus was a few verses earlier singing. "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah." This man is the one urging him to avoid the cross. It makes avoiding the cross seem so right, so proper somehow, when the proposal comes from such a trusted source, his precious companion, Peter. No wonder Jesus feels here that he could stumble. No wonder he feels his mission is genuinely endangered in this moment. Imagine your godly best friend, whose fellowship has been for years such a blessing to you. Imagine he or she one day encouraged you to go out and get drunk. Imagine one of your elders at NREC one day suggested you go and have an affair with someone. It would be so disorientating. It would make your head spin. That suggestion coming from that person. And Adam's head spins as he hears his beloved Eve telling him to do what God has told him not to do. And in a similar way, Jesus' head spins as he hears his beloved Peter telling him not to do what God has told him to do. Because what we have in Matthew 16 here, I'm saying, is Eden replayed. And Satan desperately trying to fell Jesus as once he had felled Jesus' predecessor. That's what we grasp as Jesus utters those words, "Get behind me, Satan." So how do we react? Well, we gasp, we groan, we grasp, but then fourthly and finally, we glory. We glory. I said I would comment on the "get behind me" bit. What exactly does Jesus mean by that? Well, a couple of things, I think. On the one hand, it's a rebuking comment. Look at the next verse. It's outside of our text, strictly speaking, but look at the next verse, verse 24, where we read, "Then Jesus told his disciples, 'If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me.'" But the words "come after me" are literally in the Greek "come behind me," exactly the same Greek word as we've just had in verse 23. So that I think Jesus is saying in verse 23, "Peter, your role as a disciple of mine is not to stand in front of me and stop me taking up a cross. Your role is to get behind me and follow my lead and take up a cross yourself." That's what Jesus is saying. And it's a rebuking comment, but of course it's a rebuking comment which ultimately Peter heeded, isn't it? Because the man who here was so averse to the concept of Christ suffering would later write to Christians, "Rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings," 1 Peter 4, verse 13. And the man who wouldn't countenance here any talk of dying on a cross would one day, we have good reason to believe, die on a cross himself. So it's a rebuking comment, and a rebuking comment which perhaps haunted Peter for the rest of his life, and which he took to heart, and on the basis of which he changed his whole thinking. But then on the other hand, it's a defiant comment. It's a defiant comment. Think about it. Peter is a stumbling block in the way of Jesus dying on the cross. For that stumbling block to be behind Jesus, what would that mean? Well, it would mean that he had successfully negotiated it and was advancing toward the cross. I'm sure I heard Chris Mason, the political editor on BBC News, used this kind of language a couple of days ago when Andy Burnham was given permission by the Labour Party to stand in the Makerfield by-election. Chris Mason said something like, "The first hurdle in his path to becoming Prime Minister is now behind him." And Jesus is saying here, Peter, when you say words like, "Far be it from you, Lord," that's not a small thing. That hits me hard. That hurts me. That is a genuine threat to my mission. You really are a stumbling block to me. A massive, highly dangerous stumbling block. However, Peter, you won't succeed in tripping me up and throwing me off course. I'll get past you, past this stumbling block. This "far be it from you, Lord" will not spell the end of my journey to the cross. I'll leave this moment of temptation in my wake. I will leave it behind me as I continue towards Golgotha. And it's a wonderful thing then, this defiance here in Jesus. In Adam's case, he didn't get past Eve. He wasn't able to look back at that moment of temptation beneath the branches of the tree. He wasn't able to look back at that moment of temptation now behind him as he continued on in obedience to God. No, Eve ended his obedience to God. In Eve and her outstretched hand offering that fruit, Adam's obedience hit the buffers. But Jesus' obedience didn't hit the buffers in Peter. To be sure, it was seriously threatened by Peter. But it got the better of Peter, and on it went with Peter in the rearview mirror. What a saviour this is. What a saviour. I don't know whether every hurdle between Andy Burnham and 10 Downing Street will be put behind him, like the first one has been. But I know that every hurdle between Jesus and the cross was put behind him. And on he went, and on he went, and on he went, and obstacle after obstacle presented itself, and obstacle after obstacle ended up behind him in his wake as he carried on. And he made it, folks. He made it. He reached the cross. He went all the way. And therefore, all is well this morning. Everything doesn't depend on Andy Burnham going all the way, whatever his supporters may say to the contrary. But everything, literally everything, depended on Jesus going all the way. And he went all the way. And therefore, there is salvation for this world that Adam once ruined. His catastrophic failure doesn't have the last word. All is well this morning, and hence we glory. We glory in this defiantly obedient Jesus. How did he successfully negotiate this treacherous stumbling block? Well, I think there's a clue in our passage. You know, as Jesus describes to his disciples in verse 21 what's going to happen to him, Peter doesn't really hear him. Now, you might say, what are you talking about? Of course he hears him, Dan. He hears that Jesus is going to suffer many things and is going to be killed. That's why he's so perturbed in verse 22. Well, yes, okay. He hears that bit. But there's more, isn't there? Jesus doesn't just talk about suffering many things and being killed. Look at the end of verse 21. And on the third day, be raised. There's no sign that that bit of what Jesus said made the slightest impression on Peter. Just washed over him. And yet I would put it to you that the very bit that Peter failed to hear is precisely the most important bit of all to Jesus. It's the bit he's clinging to. Beyond the suffering and death, God is going to raise me. In other words, Jesus can resist this temptation, powerful though it is, that comes through Peter here, because he's not thinking in the short term. From a short-term perspective, Peter's dead right, isn't he? The cross is terrible and self-evidently to be avoided. But Jesus has a different perspective. He can see beyond the cross to resurrection, the other side. And thus Peter isn't right. Avoidance is not the only option. And let's admire then Jesus' long-term perspective here by which he resisted this temptation, because he could see through and past and beyond the terrible cross to what lay the other side. But as I close, let's also be clear on this. A long-term perspective is what you and I are also going to need if we're going to resist temptation. There are lifestyles on offer in this world that can seem very alluring. Living for money, living for academic or professional success, living for sexual pleasure, whatever it might be. There are some very alluring lifestyle possibilities out there. And in the face then of all those alluring lifestyles, here's the one that Jesus offers. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. From a short-term perspective, those other lifestyles win hands down. But we must have a different perspective. The perspective that the writer to the Hebrews said his readers had at the start of their Christian lives. Do you remember in chapter 10, verse 34 of Hebrews, he says, recapping how they had been at the start of their Christian lives some years earlier, you sympathized with those in prison, and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property. Why? Because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. They didn't have better and lasting possessions right there, right then. They were poor, but they had better and lasting possessions in the future, in that heavenly country of which the writer speaks in chapter 11 of that epistle. You remember how in chapter 12 and verse 16 of Hebrews, the writer speaks ever so poignantly, doesn't he, of Esau, who he says sold his birthright for a single meal. What an exchange. What a disparity between a birthright with all the significance and privilege of that and a single meal that'll be forgotten about a few hours later. But you see how Esau was thinking in the short term. The birthright, that would only come into its own much later on. The meal, on the other hand, that would fill his stomach now and he could smell it and he could taste it almost already. And so he went for the meal. And that's what the writer to the Hebrews is worried that his readers are going to do. That they're going to think in the short term and opt for some alternative to Christianity that offers lots in the right here, right now. And you will sometimes be tempted to do that. Tempted to sell your birthright for a single meal. Tempted to opt for some alternative to Christianity that offers lots right here, right now. And I'm saying to you, don't succumb. Don't succumb. Be like Jesus. Be like your elder brother. Be like your master. Follow in his footsteps. That's not, as I said in session one, that's not the primary significance of this series and of Jesus' temptations. The primary significance is he's our Adam and he's triumphing for us and securing something for us on our behalf. That's the primary thing. But he is also our example. He is also our pioneer who's gone before us. He is also our elder brother. And so emulate him. You have the same spirit in you, the same Holy Spirit that he had in him. So emulate him. Be like him. Think long term, not short term. Think birthright, not single meal. Think eternal possessions, not present possessions. Think the city that lies ahead to which we are heading. That's how you'll resist temptation. Jesus was thinking, I'm going to be raised. There's a third day coming. Yes, there's a Friday coming. And that's going to be terrible. And I'm trembling at the thought of it. But there's a Sunday coming as well. And that grave's going to be opened and I'm going to come out. And I'm going to live forever in the power of an indestructible life. And we need to think like that. Yes, for the years ahead, there may be hardship. Taking up a cross and following. But the other side, there's glory. And it will not ever end. Think long term, not short term. Amen.